From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. On this edition of Fresh Air, the varied life of Norman Rush. He was a conscientious objector during the Korean War, bought and sold rare books, and for 5 years ran the Peace Corps in Botswana. That last job gave him plenty of material for his new novel about Africa, Mating. On this edition of Fresh Air, we meet Norman Rush. Also today, economist Sylvia Ann Hewlett examines how America could take better care of its children. And rock historian Ed Ward tells us the story of Don and Dewey. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The United States is reportedly making provisions to send nearly 100 Patriot missiles and about 1,300 troops from Germany to Saudi Arabia. A senior Pentagon official said today that the missile battalions will be sent out tomorrow. The official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, said that the weapons have been requested by the Saudis amid new conflicts over the detention of UN weapons inspectors in Iraq. President Bush said last week that he'd provide the missiles to Saudi Arabia for defensive purposes. The president warned Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein today not to miscalculate the United States' determination to respond to interference with the weapons inspections. In Damascus, Syrian television has shown pictures of the elderly British hostage Jack Mann, who was freed earlier today in Beirut by the pro-Iranian Revolutionary Justice Organization. Mike Theodulu reports.
Pictures of Jack Mann showed all too clearly the effects of nearly 30 months in captivity. He looked weak and haggard, a shock of white hair swept back from his pale, drawn face. But he managed to smile as he spoke to Syrian officials, and, speaking in a whisper, he said, "It's magnificent to be free. I've never been so welcomed in all my life." He said he lost his voice in captivity because his kidnappers wouldn't let him speak. Mann's wife, Sunny, has flown to Damascus from nearby Cyprus, what's expected to be an emotional reunion. They'll fly back to England later tonight if he's up to the journey. He said, "It will take me a little time to recover." For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
With the Senate judiciary vote on the nomination of Clarence Thomas just days away, members of the Senate are beginning to announce how they will vote on Thomas' confirmation. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
This morning on the floor of the Senate, two Republicans and a Democrat stood up to say how they will vote on the nomination of Clarence Thomas. None of the announcements was a surprise. Republicans Slade Gorton of Washington and Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas said they would vote for Thomas. Vermont Democrat Patrick Leahy, a member of the Judiciary Committee, announced that he would vote no.
Judge Thomas has overcome what for many has been insurmountable obstacles. He's done it with admirable courage and determination. But that triumph alone cannot propel him to a seat on the United States Supreme Court.
Leahy said the hearings left him with doubts about Thomas's legal abilities and about his views on a woman's right to choose whether or not to terminate a pregnancy. Although it's expected that Leahy will be joined by more than a dozen other senators in opposition to Thomas, the nominee's confirmation is not in any danger of being derailed. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 18 points to close at 3,029. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3. This is NPR. A senior analyst for the Central Intelligence Agency said today that he told Robert Gates about the Iran-Contra money diversions in 1986. CIA official Charles Allen told the Senate Intelligence Committee that Gates appeared startled to learn that money was apparently being illegally diverted to the rebels in Nicaragua. Throughout the hearings on his nomination to head the CIA, Gates has insisted that he was not told of the White House role in the affair. Gates specifically has said that Allen never mentioned the affair to him. Allen told the panel today that he met with Gates twice in October of 1986 and gave him a detailed account of his suspicions about the affair. The Pentagon says the remaining U.S. troops stationed in Turkey as part of Operation Provide Comfort will be returning to their units soon. At the same time, the United States is sending in more warplanes to the region, but only for use by the relief effort. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The Pentagon says it is decreasing the ground component of Operation Provide Comfort as it increases the air component. The U.S. is sending in a number of additional fixed-wing aircraft to the Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, including such attack aircraft as F-111s. Still, Pentagon spokesman Pete Williams seemed to rule out their use in any planned action in Iraq.
The planes that are there now are for the Provide Comfort mission, period.
There are nearly 1,200 U.S. ground troops remaining in Turkey as part of Operation Provide Comfort. Williams says they will be returned to their units in the next month. The last of the Provide Comfort ground forces withdrew from Iraq in mid-July. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
Croatia charged today that the Yugoslav Federal Army has committed a major violation of the ceasefire with an air attack on a strategic Croatian town. The Croatian prime minister has also demanded the complete withdrawal of the Federal Army as a precondition for peace. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. In the late 70s, Norman Rush and his wife were co-directors of the Peace Corps in Botswana in southern Africa. When he returned to the States in 1983, Rush began to write stories about the American presence in Africa. First came his book of short stories, Whites, and now Rush has written a novel called Mating. It's a comedy of manners about courtship and utopian fantasies. The story revolves around two characters, a young female anthropologist and an older male scientist who has created a haven for destitute African women in the middle of the Kalahari Desert. Rush has written the story in a woman's voice. I asked him to read from the opening page of his book.
In Africa, you want more, I think. People get avid. This takes different forms in different people, but it shows up in some form in everybody who stays there any length of time. It can be sudden. I include myself. Obviously, I mean whites in Africa and not black Africans. The average black African has the opposite problem. He or she doesn't want enough. A whole profession called rural animation exists, devoted to making villagers want more and work harder to get it. Africans are pretty ungreedy. Elites accepted, naturally. Elites are elites. But in Africa, you see middle-class white people you know for a fact are highly normal turn overnight into chain smokers or heavy drinkers or gourmets. Suddenly, you find otherwise serious people wedged in among the maids of the truly rich in the throng at the Chinese butchery, their faces clenched, determined to come away with one of the 9 or 10 half pints of creme fraiche that arrive from Mafeking on Wednesdays at 3. You see people fixate on eating wonderfully despite the derisory palette Botswana offers. Or they may get into quantity sex. Or you can see it strike them that there's no reason they shouldn't take a stab at getting rich before they have to leave Africa. Most expatriates can only stay for a few years, and like clockwork, when they get toward the end, they start buying up carasses or carvings to resell, or they decide to buy real estate through Botswana proxies, or in one case, to found the first peewee golf course south of the Sahara. I knew someone who was an ect mama's boy in real life who took insane risks smuggling wristwatches into Zimbabwe on weekends. He was at the very end of his contract. He was teaching law at the University of Botswana.
You were a member of the Foreign Service, and you and your wife actually directed the Peace Corps program in Botswana.
That's right. Yes, we did.
What took you to Botswana?
Well, two things, I think, together. One was a desire for adventure and the opportunity to look into strata of life that would otherwise forever be closed to us, and the other was a chance to do a little good, maybe, if we were lucky. So it was an irresistible combination.
This is Botswana of the late 70s and early 80s.
Right, 78 to 83.
What was the political, cultural climate there at the time?
Well, for us, it was, I guess you could say, you could describe Botswana as being an island of tranquility surrounded by conflict, armed struggle, everywhere you looked. In Namibia, there was the Swapo rebellion was going on. Zimbabwe, the guerrilla war was coming to an end there. In South Africa, apartheid was in crisis, of course. And in those days, Botswana was the first port of call for people leaving, refugees and exiles. And the South Africans had not yet electrified the border fence along the Limpopo, so people were wading across and coming in that way. And
was it geography, then, that made Botswana this kind of haven?
Yeah, Botswana became this kind of tranquil place because it was in everybody's interest for it to be that way. And all of the major powers had some sort of representation there because everyone had a stake in how it came out in South Africa. And, of course, the South Africans had their own special branch people undercover in Botswana. So it was a climate that was intensely alive politically, and you were never quite sure who was who in that situation.
What kind of programs did the Peace Corps have there? What kinds of things were they trying to promote?
We supplied teachers for secondary schools, drought relief workers, borehole mechanics, that is people who were training local people to run diesel pumps, tuberculosis control, a broad range, small business development, agriculture. It was a broadly based program of about 120 volunteers, 100 to 120 volunteers over the time span we were there.
I'm curious about the outsiders, even the white people that came to Botswana. You described being there, you wanted to do some good, and you were looking, I guess, for something else. Would you say that characterized other people as well?
Well, it's different for different categories of people. I think that I'm rather hard on the Brits in this book, and I think that a lot of the Brits who were there for a different reason. They were there because they had had it pretty good up further up in Africa, and as decolonization had rolled them down further and further south, they'd gotten more and more disgruntled, and yet they were not prepared to go back to cloudy England ever. Americans coming into that part of the world come in with a feeling of very clean hands, I think mistakenly, but since they were never original colonizers, they feel that they come in as an ex-colonial, as a representation of ex-colonial intelligence and intentions, and they're not seen that way, of course. So it makes for a very interesting mixture of political attitudes.
Did you have? I'm wondering, even at the sort of end of your term in the Foreign Service or with the Peace Corps, could you have stayed on if you wanted to?
Well, Peace Corps has a rule, which is called the 5-year rule. Then that's you're out after that, because the notion was that they did not want to create a permanent bureaucracy, revolving. So they want new blood.
Were you ready to go?
We were very tired. Yeah, at the end of 5 years, it's a grueling job. And in fact, I didn't get any writing done while I was in Africa. It was all in the future. I took notes. I brought back tapes and maps and notes of all kinds of things. But there was never any time. It's a 24-hour-a-day job being Peace Corps director.
And were you even doing any kind of mental writing?
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. There's no way that I found it so literarily stimulating that there was no way that I wasn't starting stories in my head the whole time. And when I did sit down, when I got back to the United States, everything came very rapidly to me. So clearly some kind of unconscious process of composition had been underway.
I think people that have never been to Africa or certainly the various and variety of countries in Africa don't understand what a rich environment that is. I think, mm-hmm. I mean, we read, of course, about the terrible famines, the starvations, the civil wars, which are all very real.
Yeah.
But there's this other part of it, and perhaps even only well-off people get a chance to participate in that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what that is?
Well, it's the variety of life in Africa is in a way misrepresents what you find in Botswana, because life is concentrated very much in the southern and eastern part of the country. It's a big country. It's huge. It's as big as France or Texas. When we were there, it had a population of about 1 million, and that population was mostly concentrated in the strip along the border with South Africa leading up toward Zimbabwe. Where the railway was, the railway line was. But in the north is a very exotic and different kind of society and kind of country. There's a beheaded river up there which produces an inland delta called the Okavango Swamp, which is the last great unfenced game area in the world. And in the desert you have Basarwa, Bushmen, living the last hunter-gatherers, not very many of them actually hunting and gathering anymore, if you read my book, but bands of them in the Kalahari. And spread out across the country, isolated settlements of people evolving becoming and surviving in their own way, utterly in their own way. So it appears to be a blank, but it's not.
Well, how does that get under your skin?
Well, it gets under your skin because you want to understand it. You want to understand how people can live, for example, how people can live with equanimity in the midst of what looks like total desolation, have normal lives, clusters of families in the midst of an absolute desolation, little path leading off to ultimately to a trek route. You would think that this would lead to a sort of impoverished life, but when you get to know these people, you discover enormous qualities and interest in life and everything that makes another human being interesting.
Does that solve a kind of riddle then that you have about human nature?
No, it only adds to it. Right. I think I'm not closer to solving the mystery of the world, as my narrator calls it. But let me just also say, there's another thing about Africa's an astonishing place, and you see things that you're not prepared for all the time. This is kind of a trivial example, but it illustrates the kind of aesthetics shocks that you receive. We were passing through a segment of the Kalahari Desert and came over a rise, and there on the ground in front of us across the roadway were indescribable objects, indescribably beautiful and enigmatic, not identifiable. And it took us a while to figure out what they were. It was late afternoon. The sun was shining in a sort of golden way on these things. And we stopped and discovered that what we were looking at were clods of elephant dung, spherical, quite large. A herd had obviously passed that way. And each clod of dung had been colonized by a different species of butterfly. So these things looked like surreal Christmas tree ornaments distributed across the road, waving, the wings waving, and the colors iridescent and magical. But from 20 feet away, you could not understand what you were seeing.
Norman Rush is my guest today, and from 1978 until the early 80s, for 5 years, he and his wife ran the Peace Corps program in Botswana. They were members of the Foreign Service. He's written two books. His first one is called Whites, and his latest one is called Mating. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Writer Norman Rush is my guest. You spent some time, in fact, many years, as a rare books dealer.
Right, that was, yeah.
And was it was there something about being surrounded? And I guess I have this image of this, you know, mountain of rare books, and somehow you and
that's very that's very close to the unfortunate truth, and I still haven't cleared the decks. My wife I've made promises to her about this, and I'm still clinging to my stock.
I see perhaps these two streams of influences, and I guess I think of these old books and the kind of rich language and perhaps old stories, and then I think of perhaps even the correspondence that you had to do in the Peace Corps, which I imagine is, you know, very terse kind of writing, and I see kind of evidences of both those in Mating.
Well, yes, you probably do, and also some of the miscellaneous saning up of odd facts. Turned my characters, I've shared that trait with at least one of the characters. Yeah, that's true. The interest in words also is something that I think people have remarked on the vocabulary of the narrator. And been kind of made much of it. I don't really think that it's that extraordinary for somebody who is coming upward from the underclass to seize on language and a command of language as a way of demonstrating power in the world. And I've known people like this in academic and sub-academic circles. So she's not a willful invention. Mm-hmm. But I confess also to an interest in words, and I think that it's fun to think about how this medium that we use to connect to one another, and how imperfect and how comical it is at times.
Does that mean, as a writer, you go over and over and over to, because the importance of the words to you, that it takes a long time to get them right?
Yeah, I have a perfectionist tendency, I have to say. Although I do not as many drafts as other writers do, but I do a lot of thinking before I write. And it's one reason that I haven't been attracted to the word processor, because so much of what goes on is sort of pre-sorted before I get it down.
Well, how would a word processor inhibit that?
Well, I think people tend to write a great deal, then look at it, and then change it. And I tend to internally do what happens on the screen and then get it down. And I've never adapted to the idea of, I don't think that print appearing on a screen is the same thing. Typing is almost like publishing, I mean, for me in a certain way. So I'm staying with my primitive typewriter, for the time being anyway.
Does that mean non-electric or electric?
No, non-electric. it's a genuine antique, and I'm so wedded to the typeface. It's an elite face that doesn't exist anymore in the world. So I don't know. I think maybe I'll be in trouble when this thing goes.
Norman Rush is my guest, and his latest book, it's a novel, is called Mating. You were a conscientious objector. This is going back many years. Conscientious objector.
It's going way back, yeah.
During the Korean War.
Right.
And actually went to prison.
Yes.
Would you say this kind of activism, I assume, and this kind of opinionated feelings about politics, has that really continued then through your life?
I have to say yes. I'm still opinionated. I'm still a pacifist. I went to prison because there was no accommodation in the law for someone who was opposed to war and who was not religious. I was objected on moral grounds, but not religious grounds, to war and to killing. And there are echoes of that, of course, in the book throughout. And I haven't changed my views, at least on those issues, and over time.
How did you spend your time in prison?
I worked in the boiler room, mostly at night, which was where we burned logs to generate electricity and steam and heat for the prison camp. This was in Tucson, Arizona, minimum security prison in the Catalina Rincon Mountains. I was there for 9 months of a 2-year sentence. I was paroled directly to, almost directly to Swarthmore College, where I proceeded to fall in love with the daughter of the special agent in charge of the FBI in New York City. And if you want to talk about unlikely matings, that the prospects were certainly odd for that one.
Did you feel angry that you had to serve time in prison, or did you feel that was the price of your beliefs?
No, that was par for the course. And I felt the usual things that a young man feels, all of the questions as to whether cowardice was involved in what I was doing, some unconscious level. So the tiny ordeal that I went through was something I was completely prepared to accept. And actually, it was a fascinating experience, too, although I haven't written about it, but it was.
Fascinating as you look back on
it? Yeah, looking back on it, the people that I met there and the things it did to my way of looking at the world.
Can you be more descriptive?
Well, once you've been in jail, you look at the world differently. You see that you taste what the real sanction is in the making of society, and changes your sympathies, I think, in some profound way. Also, in those days, I was still, you still remain subject to selective service. I was, until I was about 25 or 26, was still subject to being recalled and having to go through the whole process again. So it gave me a kind of a fugitive outlook on things while this was going, and nourished the oppositional side of my perceptions, I think.
Did you come from a pacifist family?
Yes. My father ultimately became a pacifist, although he became many other things, too. He started out as a socialist and as an organizer for the Socialist Party in California and a union organizer. When I was born, he received instructions from my mother that all this had to stop and he had to get a job that would pay something. And he became the opposite of what he had been. He became a salesman and a trainer of salesmen. And his intellectual trajectory ultimately took him to Rosicrucianism and theosophy.
Huh.
But in at one small segment in there, he was a pacifist, and it was there that I got my first introduction to pacifist ideas.
And did he support, then, you're going to jail?
Oh, yes, yeah, he understood that. There was never any question about that.
The dedication, or at least the very beginning mm-hmm. of your book, is a very powerful and emotional... it's very powerful and emotional. I was wondering if you could read it for us.
Sure. Everything I write is for Elsa, but especially this book, since in it her heart, sensibility, and intellect are so signally, if perforce esoterically, celebrated and exploited. My debt to her in art and in life grows, however much I put against it. I also dedicate mating to my beloved son and daughter-in-law, Jason and Monica, to my mother and to the memory of my father and to my lost child, Liza. And to explain the last, I have a daughter who's now 30, who was born with diffuse brain atrophy and has been institutionalized for many years. But I think the rest is pretty self-explanatory.
What is her condition?
She is profoundly retarded and will be so.
So you feel she's lost to you?
Yes, there is no recognition, possible between her and us.
Well, what really struck me about that very beginning was just this sense of family that I got. Mm-hmm. I mean, family in the sort of the deepest sense of the word.
Uh-huh. Well, yes, and it's kind of an achievement too. We went through probably the most ferocious adolescence with our son that any family ever survived. And it's now turned out it's all in the past and everything is wonderful, but it was a severe test. He is a mathematician at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he chose mathematics specifically as something that neither one of us had anything to do with. No politics, no art. My wife is a weaver and a textile designer. No politics, no art. So this was his choice. We have a terrific family relationship now.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us today.
It was my great pleasure.
Norman Rush's novel is called Mating. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscowain with Fresh Air. If children are our future, Sylvia Ann Hewlett contends our future looks pretty bleak. She says it's getting harder and harder for parents to juggle work and raise a family. And she says that both government and business are too slow with programs and policies that would make things better. Coming up, Sylvia Ann Hewlett gives us some of her suggestions. And rock historian Ed Ward profiles the songwriting team of Don Harris and Dewey Terry. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A senior Pentagon official says that the U.S. will send nearly 100 Patriot missiles and around 1,300 troops to Saudi Arabia tomorrow. President Bush had said last week that he would provide the missiles to Saudi Arabia for defensive purposes. The weapons have been requested as tension grew in the Persian Gulf region in a dispute with Iraqi President Saddam Hussein over U.N. weapons inspections. In the meantime, the U.N. Security Council says that it has a letter from Iraq, accepting the U.N.'s right to send helicopter surveillance flights over Iraqi weapons installations. Israeli Prime Minister Shamir said today that all of the occupied territories belong to Israel and that Jewish settlements will continue, a statement that is likely to concern the Bush administration. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Shamir was speaking at the dedication ceremony of the new settlement of Tsur Yigal on the border between Israel and the West Bank. All of the territories are ours, Shamir said. Anything that can be built up will be settled with Jews to the edge of the horizon. Shamir also said that the Green Line, the line dividing Israel from the West Bank, no longer exists. Israeli leftists criticized both the new settlement and Shamir's statements. Left-wing Knesset member Dedi Tzuker said the new settlement could endanger both the peace process and American loan guarantees for immigrant absorption. Tzuker also charged that Israel is building four new settlements in the West Bank and intends to spend more than $1 billion in the territories. Housing Ministry officials rejected these charges. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
A high-level intelligence official has testified that he warned Robert Gates, nominated to head the CIA, of White House involvement in the Iran-Contra affair. Gates has testified he cannot recall being told that any U.S. officials were involved. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Charles Allen, a CIA analyst who will work under Gates if he's confirmed, told the Senate Intelligence Committee today that he laid out evidence in October of 1986 to Gates that profits from arms sales to Iran were being diverted to aid the Nicaraguan Contras.
Mr. Gates appeared startled and disturbed that the White House would involve itself in such a dubious activity, but then stated that this was potentially very serious and directed that I brief Director Casey immediately.
In previous testimony, Gates says he first learned of the diversion from Allen, but he called it flimsy speculation. But Gates said last week that he did not recall any reference to Oliver North or any U.S. officials' involvement. The chairman of the Intelligence Committee today acknowledged some contradiction in testimony, but said the committee couldn't pursue every single ambiguity. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 18 points in very active trading. This is NPR News. After being held hostage for over 2 years, 77-year-old Jack Mann was set free in Beirut today and taken to Damascus. At a packed news conference, Mann, speaking in a hoarse whisper, said this morning he started another dreadful day, wondering how much longer. As he was led from the room, he appeared dazed under the bright television lights. Earlier, British Prime Minister John Major said that he had heard that Mann was a little unwell. A prosecution witness in the drug trafficking trial of former Panamanian leader Manuel Noriega admitted today that some of the testimony he gave yesterday was erroneous. Lieutenant Luis del Cid, Noriega's former bodyguard, said the mistakes involved a government charge that Noriega and Cuba's Fidel Castro discussed drug trafficking at a meeting in 1984. NPR's John Dingus reports from Miami.
Yesterday, under prosecution questioning, Del Cid gave testimony that supported the government charge. He said he notified Noriega that a cocaine laboratory in Panama was raided and that Noriega convened a meeting in Havana to talk about the problem. According to the prosecution, Fidel Castro brokered the return of protection money paid to Noriega by the Colombian cocaine cartel. But today, on cross-examination, Del Cid admitted that he had some key facts wrong. Noriega actually ordered the raid on the cocaine laboratory, and Del Cid acknowledged that the trip to Cuba was previously scheduled, not suddenly added to Noriega's itinerary because of the drug raid. He also said that another Panamanian officer was accused of receiving the protection money, and that that officer was arrested and dishonorably discharged. In Miami, this is John Dinges.
According to Soviet news reports, Russian President Boris Yeltsin, who was said last week to be suffering from heart problems, will take a two-week-long vacation. Reports of a heart ailment for the Russian leader have had a very large impact on financial markets. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Vacation leave and sick days are pretty standard benefits for most working people. But employee benefits which recognize the needs of raising a family are not so prevalent. Sylvia Ann Hewlett is an economist who thinks about what it takes to raise kids. She's distressed about how private and public policies are putting children in this country at risk by ignoring the needs of the family. She's the author of When the Bough Breaks, The Cost of Neglecting Our Children. Hewlett calls for nationalized health insurance, a child support program, and other government programs which invest in children. And she says there are some corporate policies that would quickly pay for themselves.
There are now about four studies done by firms as different as IBM and Merck, which really show that if you provide decent parenting leave with suitable job protections, you really reduce your turnover costs. We are in a labor scarce economy these days where skills are really quite hard to find. Now, obviously, if you create a maternity or parenting leave policy, which makes it possible for that woman to go on working for your company, you really avoid those costs. And Merck has found that for each employee that they keep as a result of their now good parenting leave policies, they save about $12,000 to $18,000 because those are the costs that they would have incurred had they lost the worker. So I guess what I'm trying to say, and I really spell out all of these studies in my book, there is now quite a lot of impressive data that shows that parenting leave is really a good idea for the firm as well as for the parent and the child. In fact, you know, when President Bush vetoed that parenting leave bill last year, the day after there was a letter written into the Washington Post by the CEO of Control Data, and it said, "Dear Mr. President, you did not do your homework. Had you looked at the data, you could have figured out that parenting leave is one of the best investments any firm can make." And it was interesting that that response really came from the private sector, from a firm that had had those policies in place for a while.
Why then don't we see the private sector rallying around these ideas, which include parental leave, child care, prenatal and maternal leave, and many other reforms that you outline in your book?
Well, we're beginning to see it. Marty, one very interesting fact is that the number of companies that have packages of benefits and policies around families has quadrupled over the last 5 years. That is really a very rapid rate of increase. Now, obviously, you're much more likely to get these ideas spreading if we had a little leadership from Washington. I mean, what I advocate in my book is that the kind of data that I've put together, the kind of data that, you know, the CEO of Control Data is in touch with, is really made available for companies across America, because clearly, you know, small and medium-sized firms perhaps don't have the resources to do these kinds of studies. But I think if we had some real drive and leadership on these issues, you would see the private sector moving even faster, because we are moving into a decade of very severe skill shortages. Just think of it, only 10% of the incoming workers over the next decade will be white males. Everyone else will either be a working mother or a member of a minority. And these groups do need these kinds of supports if they're to become productive workers. Otherwise, the various burdens in their lives really get in the way of continuous employment and that kind of thing. And I think increasingly any firm that looks into the future realizes that family supports has to be part of any productive workforce as you head towards the end of this century.
Americans get a tax deduction for their children. Can you compare this to a universal child allowance? Are these two different ways of coming to the same end?
Well, I think that a child allowance or family allowance is a rather better way of dealing with the issue of how to, put more money in the pockets of those who are raising children. Because if it is universal and is not kind of dependent on earning power, it really gives more support to those who need it more. In other words, what I would like to see is some kind of flat family allowance, several thousands of dollars per child, that is given to any parent who is raising a child, say, under 6 years old. And that is not only a very fair and non-bureaucratic response to the problem, but I think it also gives a great deal of choice to the parent, because you can either use that money and help it subsidize your life so that you perhaps can work part-time instead of full-time for those years and actually look after your child part of the time yourself, or you can use it to buy better childcare.
What countries have a universal child allowance, and what have been the benefits to that country?
Most countries do. I've counted about 18 in Europe. Canada, Australia has it. In some of these countries, it's not a very significant sum of money, but it does provide some kind of cushion for those early years of life. And again, most of these countries, they have upgraded this allowance in recent years. I think that, say $3,000 per child up until age six would make a significant difference.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Sylvia Ann Hewlett. She's an economist and the author of a book called When the Bough Breaks, The Cost of Neglecting Our Children. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with Sylvia Ann Hewlett, and her book is called When the Bough Breaks. There's some evidence to show that people are working much more than a 40-hour work week, that there really is a lengthening of the work week. Is that a sign of some kind of work insecurity, that unless you put in the 50 or 60 hours, you might be out of a job?
Absolutely. And again, the figures are very dramatic. Between 1980 and 1990, the number of hours spent on the job went up about 6 hours per week for each working American. Children are facing the consequences of this increase in the work week. If both mom and dad are at work, 6 hours more per week than they used to, clearly that eats into the amount of time available for children. There was one interesting study in California recently which looked at eighth grade students, kids that are at an age where substance abuse is beginning to be a problem for the first time. And they found that the number of hours these youngsters were left at home without an adult present was the biggest indicator of whether that child would get involved in drugs or alcohol. And they really tested it across class, across race, and it didn't matter whether you were black or white, it didn't matter what income group you came from, what did matter was how many hours you were at home alone during the week. And interestingly enough, the kid that was at greatest risk of substance abuse in this study was the kid with the two professional parent family. In other words, if you have a mom that has a job, at least she will be home by, 5:30, 6 o'clock. But if you have a mom that has a career, maybe she's not home till 8 o'clock. And it was the children of the high-achieving professional couple that seemed to come out, you know, the worst in this study because they saw the least of their parents of any in the group.
Are you calling for then a return to traditional roles? Are you saying that children really are going to be better off if their mothers stay at home and take care of them and the house?
Marty, I'm very glad you asked me that directly. I'm not advocating that at all. You know, in some ways, we sometimes look back at the 1950s, you know, the Norman Rockwell America, where you had the breadwinning husband and the homemaking wife, you know, the two kids, the dog, the station wagon, the whole bit, as a very attractive and appealing vision of what family life should be like. Well, I guess what I try and prove over and over again in my book is that vision, that kind of leave it to beaver America, has really gone for good. And I think the great goal of policy over the next 10 years is to produce a more palatable reality, to change, you know, the workplace so that you can produce the flexibility to make it work better for the family. And let me just be very specific here. American Express is a company right now that's experimenting with giving parents the gift of time. And they don't mean giving, you know, women 10 years off so they can be 1950s moms. They don't mean that at all. What they mean is that they will be flexible in terms of hours. They will create at-home options. They will create compressed work weeks so that working parents can work a full 40-hour week in, say, a three-day long weekend. And if you look at the most imaginative companies right now, they're really changing the rules in terms of when, where, and how work is done. And I think that is the great challenge of the 1990s, to make work and family more compatible by being imaginative, particularly in terms of time scheduling.
Are there some lessons in Social Security, which has been able to bring really millions of elderly out of poverty? Can we apply those same lessons and even the same economic policy to the nation's children?
Well, this is a very critical issue because right now we spend something like 28% of the federal budget on the elderly and just 4% on children. And what I suggest is that you know, how come we managed to give such priority to the elderly and have really failed to give any priority to children whatsoever? And, you know, one of the tricks, obviously, with the very successful movement on behalf of the elderly is that it's worked for the kind of universal benefit of all elderly people. In other words, it hasn't just been the elderly in need that have benefit. It's really been right across classes, and, you know, mainstream elderly people really benefit enormously too. And in a sense, I'd like to borrow some of that logic and apply it to children. I think, for instance, things like a child allowance, things like parenting leave should be universally available. And I feel in a way that if we had an organization for parents like the AARP, which has been, you know, so successful in mobilizing the elderly, we would be able to mobilize this parental, you know, block of voters and make their voice heard in Washington.
Sylvia Ann Hewlett is an economist and author of When the Bough Breaks, The Cost of Neglecting Our Children. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up. Robert Siegel has joined us to tell us about the show today. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Marty. We'll be hearing news about the release of hostage Jack Mann from Lebanon, where he was held in, hostage for several years in Syria. Also, the surrender of Marcus Wolf, the former head of East German intelligence, to authorities in Germany. We'll also hear about the financial problems of the California State University systems and about the problems of gypsies in Romania. A report by an American gypsy leader who visited over the summer is that many of the children in orphanages there are of gypsy families and they're not being adopted.
Thank you, Robert. Those stories and more coming up later on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. What do Frank Zappa, John Mayall, and the Premiers have in common? Don Sugarcane Harris, electric fiddle player and half of one of the most prolific songwriting teams to come out of L.A. in the 50s. Rock historian Ed Ward says that while they never had any hits, their influence was huge. Mama Jamie, Mama Jamie.
Because of the fact that rhythm and blues is one of the main tributaries of the rock and roll river, the number of black performers who are outright rockers instead of R&B performers is small. You can count them on the fingers of one hand, almost. Chuck Berry, Little Richard, Bo Diddley, and Don and Dewey. And what's really strange is the fact that although the first three names on that list were among the best-known performers of the 50s, Don and Dewey never charted a record nationally, on the pop charts or the rhythm and blues charts. Don Sugarcane Harris and Dewey Terry grew up in Pasadena, California, just outside Los Angeles, and by their mid-teens, they'd become proficient at piano, bass, guitar, and violin, Don playing the violin. Numerous vocal groups used their services on stage and in the studio, and eventually a couple of local entrepreneurs signed Don and Dewey to play the songs they were beginning to write. One thing led to another, and before long, Don and Dewey released their first record on Specialty, Home to Little Richard. I went down to the jungle. I met a fine girl named Tom. Fine and sweet as she could be. I guess it's what you say, just a swinging through the tree. You got a jungle hopper with the beebe lip up. A jungle hopper with the beebe lip up. A naked leg old loki chinga chinga mino. Jungle hopper with the beebe lip up. She wiggle like a snake. Jungle Hop, like all of the records that followed, was a complete failure. This is hard to imagine listening to them today. Don and Dewey made some sloppy records, it's true, but occasionally they went over the top, as with this little ditty, which might have been inspired by the Marquis de Sade.
To the barber shop, gonna have her do me up, gonna get clean for my little buttercup. Dusty, 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 dusty. She my loving baby, and it means she drive me wild. Mama's, papa's, sisters, brothers, uncles, crazy child. Dusty, 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 who just won't treat me right.
This sort of thing was exactly what Los Angeles teenagers wanted, and one reason Don and Dewey got to keep recording, despite poor national sales, was that locally they were doing very well. The other reason was money. As with every artist who recorded with Specialty, including Little Richard, who recently settled a lawsuit with them, the songs Don and Dewey wrote were published by Specialty's in-house music publishing firm, Venice Music. Don and Dewey probably made Venice more money than anybody except Richard. But ironically, they made most of it after they'd all but stopped recording for Specialty. Theirs were the sort of records that circulated among musicians who played their songs to each other. In 1963, a young Cajun disc jockey turned producer handed one of Don and Dewey's songs to Dale and Grace, a brother and sister act he was producing.
I'm leaving it all. Gonna do. Now do you want my love? Or are we through?
The Dale and Grace remake shot straight to the top of the charts. In Los Angeles, the local Chicano community had kept the flame of the L.A. 50s rock and roll scene burning long after the scene had died away, and they kept Don and Dewey in work. No wonder, then, that one of the first rock bands from East L.A., The Premiers, turned this Don and Dewey song into an anthem.
Farmer John, I'm in love with your daughter.
Even Los Lobos do Farmer John. And in the era of the Coasters' story songs about bad guys and close shaves, the Olympics had a hit with another Don and Dewey number. Don and Dewey were over by 1964. Dewey dropped out of sight, but Don, well, Don showed up in the weirdest place imaginable.
I'm a little pimp with my hair gas black. Hair daddy pants with my shoes shine black. Got a little lady walk that street, telling all the boys that she can't be.
Guitar by Frank Zappa, vocal by Captain Beefheart, and violin by Don Sugarcane Harris, who may not have lasted any longer in Zappa's band than most musicians, but he's used the connection to keep himself in work ever since.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Bing, bang, bong, 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 ka-bam, boom. Bing, bang, bang, boom. Bing, bang, bang, boom. Bing, bang, bang, boom. Bing, bang, bong, 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 ka-bam, boom.
Our interviews are produced by Amy Salad and Phyllis Myers, with production help from Roberta Shorrock, Susan Weinstein, and Seuss Bolin. Our researcher is Ellen Silva. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next edition of Fresh Air, actress Claire Bloom tells us about her career-long search for the best roles. Also, we talk with reporter-turned-novelist Ward Just. That and more on the next Fresh Air.